Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Monday night installment here at Your Remedy Is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various offensive litigating strategies. And this is with our speaker, Mr. David Merlin. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy Is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy Is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless. And it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedy Is in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com. If we look in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure, better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR. The rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes all the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course, so it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known purely for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedy Is in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of YourRemedyIsInTheLaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy Is in the Law. And Your Remedy Is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at YourRemedyIsInTheLaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you'll get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points? What are you interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. But if it affects your personal rights in one way or another, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much like how you think of a network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. And maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do where I'm similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to a point where you've educated to yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedom's Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. Every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedom's Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. The information provider's payment is delivered for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that, honestly, most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. And we make those introductions. Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. The unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have had to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you call the remedy and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
All right, Martin, I thank you so very, very much for your disclaimer there. I appreciate that, and it's important that everyone on this call understands. No one here is an attorney or a member of the bar, licensed otherwise. All you will hear is what someone might do where they're similarly situated, nothing else. If you're here for legal advice or financial advice, very politely I ask, please just leave the call. That having been said, so far we've talked about, in preparation for PJ, we talked about a number of things over the last 3 weeks. I'm going through a series with you here where we talked about how you were born as a first-class citizen. Well, what does that mean? Yeah, there's two classes of citizens. There's first-class and second-class. There's citizens with rights from the Almighty One, and there are citizens with privileges from the Congress. Then we gave you, following that, the big picture, a 30,000-foot view of what's going on here in our country with regards to the foundations of our laws. Then we covered how Congress converts state citizens into federal citizens. And then we last week we talked about the origins of the federal citizen. Tonight, in preparation for PJ's work, we're going to talk about how state citizens are actually converted into federal citizens. So in order for the federal government to tax a citizen of one of the several states, it had to create some sort of a contractual nexus. You've heard PJ talk about contracts. The contractual nexus is the Social Security number. In 1935, the federal government instituted Social Security. The Social Security Board then created 10 Social Security districts. The combination of these districts resulted in a federal area, a fictional jurisdiction which covers all of the freely associated compact states like a clear plastic overlay. In 1939, the federal government instituted the Public Salary Act of 1939. The act is a municipal law specifically for the District of Columbia for collecting and for taxing all federal employees and those who live and work in any federal area. Now, the government knows it cannot tax those state citizens who live within the freely associated compact states and work outside of the territorial jurisdiction of Article 1, Section 8, Clause 2 in the Constitution of the United States of America, also known as the 10 square miles of the District of Columbia and territories, as well as enclaves. So in 1940, Congress passed the Buck Act. You've heard me talk about this. This Buck Act is found at 4 U.S.C. Section 105 through 113. Specifically in 110 E, as in Edward, this act authorized any department of the federal government to create a federal area for imposition of the Public Salary Act, Tax Act of 1939. This tax is imposed at 4 U.S.C. Section 111. The rest of the taxing law is found in the Internal Revenue Code. the Social Security Board had already created a federal area overlay, United States Code Title IV, and it did so as follows in 110D. Now listen, pay attention. The term state includes, the word includes means this is what it's limited to, nothing else but what we're talking about next. The term state includes any territory or possession of the United States. 110E, the term federal area means any lands or premises held or acquired by or for the use of the United States or any department, establishment, or agency of the United States, and any federal area or any part thereof which is located within the interior boundaries of any state shall be deemed to be federal, a federal area located within such state. Under provision of Title IV, Section 105, the federal state, also known as the state of, right, state of Florida, the state of Georgia, the state of New York, all right, is imposing an excise tax. And that section states in pertinent part, quote, Section 105, state and so forth, taxation affecting federal areas, sales, or use tax. A, no person shall be relieved from the liability of payment of, collection of, or accounting for any sales or use tax levied by any state or any duly constituted taxing authority therein, having jurisdiction to levy such tax on the ground that the sales or use with respect to which such tax is levied occurred in whole or in part within a federal area, and such state or taxing authority shall have full jurisdiction to levy such a tax by reason of his residing within a federal area and receiving income from transactions occurring or services performed in such area, and such state and taxing authority shall have full jurisdiction and power to levy and collect such tax in any federal area within such a state to the same extent and with the same effects as though such an area was not a federal area. We should note, irrespective of what the tax is called, if its purpose is to produce revenue, it is an income tax or a receipts tax under the Buck Act, found at 4 U.S.C. sections 105 through 110. You can also reference the court cases of Humble Oil and Refining versus Calvert. This is 464 Southwest 2nd. You also have several others, but we don't need to go into that. For purposes of further explanation, a federal area can include the Social Security areas designated by the Social Security Administration, any public housing that has a federal funding, a home that has a federal loan, Freddie Mac, something like that, a road that has federal funding, schools and colleges, public or private, that receive direct or indirect federal funding, and virtually everything that the federal government touches through any type of direct or indirect aid. This federal area is attached to anyone who has a Social Security number or any personal contact with the federal or the state government. And this is, of course, with the exception of those who have been defrauded through the tenets of an unrevealed contract to accept these compelled benefits, which includes me and perhaps you. Through this mechanism, the federal government usurped the sovereignty of the people as well as the sovereignty of the several states by creating federal areas within the authority of Article 4, Section 3, Clause 2 in the Constitution for the United States of America, which in their states, quote, the Congress shall have power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States, and nothing in this Constitution shall be construed as to prejudice any claims of the United States or of any particular state, end quote. Therefore, all U.S. citizens, that is, the district, citizens of the District of Columbia, residing in one of the states of the Union, are classified as property and franchisees of the federal government as an individual entity, referencing what we've shared many times before, Wheeling Steel Corporation versus Fox. So under the Buck Act, The federal government has created a federal area within the boundaries of the several states. This area is similar to any territory that the federal government acquires through purchase or conquest or treaty, thereby imposing federal territorial law upon the people in this federal area. Federal territorial law is evidenced by the executive branch's admiralty flag, which we all recognize when we walk into the schools and the offices and the courthouses, etc., which is the gold fringe. To enjoy the freedoms secured by the federal and state constitutions, you must live on the land in one of the states. Again, on the land in one of the states of the Union of the several states, and not in any federal area. PJ's covered this many times on the prior calls about, you know, did this act happen on federal land? And we've shown you how to get the map of federal lands within our country. You cannot have a valid Social Security number, a residential state driver's license. You can't have a motor vehicle registered in your name, a bank account in a federally insured bank, or any other known contract implied in fact that would place you in this federal area and thus within the territorial jurisdiction of the municipal laws of the Congress. Remember, all acts of Congress are territorial nature and can only apply within the territorial jurisdiction of the Congress. And I'd be happy to supply you with the court cases that reflect that if you want it to do. So this is not easy to do. Most banks are federally insured, and it may be inconvenient to bank at an institution that is not federally insured. And there are many things that become a little more difficult to do without a Social Security number or a driver's license or a zip code. There has been created fictional federal states of within a state. And again, I've got a number of court cases for that. Compared also against 31 CFR, parts 51.2 and 52.2, which also identify a fictional state within a state. And these fictional states are identified by the use of two-letter abbreviations. I remember growing up, the abbreviation for Florida was FLA, period. And it was capital F, lowercase LA. Now it's FL here. So what do I put when I abbreviate? FLA, period. The fictional states also use zip codes that are within the municipal exclusive legislative jurisdiction of the Congress. The Pennsylvania Commonwealth is one of the several states versus the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, also known as PA, is a subdivision of the District of Columbia. If you accept postal matter sent to PA or within a zip code, the courts say that this is evidence that you are a federal citizen or resident. Again, remember PJ talking about forcing the opposing counsel to maintain the burden of proof on them rather than your confession. The use of the zip code is voluntary. I never use a zip code, or if I do, I'll put it in a bracket or a box, which has its own meaning in law, which we can talk about later. There are domestic mail service regulations. Section 122.32 says the Postal Service cannot discriminate against the non-use of the zip code. There's also the Postal Reorganization Act, Section 403, which is public law at 91-375. The IRS has adopted, here's a good thing, the zip code areas as Internal Revenue Districts. You can find that at the Federal Register, Volume 51 and Number 53, dated March 19, 1986. The acceptance of mail with a zip code is one of the requirements for the IRS to have jurisdiction to send you notices. So what would happen if you received a notice from the IRS and you said return to sender, not a zip-coded entity or something like that. That's something you can talk to PJ about. When you apply for a Social Security number, which you probably did in your teens before the age of majority, you're telling the federal government you are repudiating your state citizenship in order to apply for the benefits of citizenship in the federal nation. Granting a Social Security number is prima facie evidence that no matter what you were before, you have voluntarily entered into a voyage for profit or gain in a negotiable instruments and maritime enterprises. This is the system that has been set up over the years to restrict, control, destroy our personal and economic liberties. Our legal system is very complicated and you may not understand how it works. And I think that that's intentional. But also as well, PJ makes it very, very clear how to keep the burden of proof and how to simplify things. So without further ado, it is my sincere pleasure to turn this call over to PJ. Give me 1 second to unmute. Ah, darn. Hold on. PJ, you clear? Here we go.
Yeah, all can right. You hear me?
Hear you perfectly clear. Thank you.
Okay.
So I think I gave you a good springboard to leap off of.
Yeah, I wish I had the documents so I could read through them. But, one of the individuals that taught me a great deal about IRS taxes, a guy named Ed Schell, and he graduated out of law school out of Michigan, top of his class, or close to, and he had the IRS code memorized. And he always told everybody that it's going to do you more damage to know the IRS code than not to. But he just read through it and memorized it just because he's good at that stuff. But anyway, he ended up beating the IRS 60 times that I know of. And I believe the government ended up killing him. But he would often talk about that these federal courts across the country are there for federal purposes. Those courts are not there for the common man. They're there for federal persons, federal activity that occurs in federal land, activity that occurs with federal entities, and if you are a man and the federal government damages you, you can go to those courts and ask for damages. You don't have to become a federal person to go into federal court. You can go in as a man that's been damaged by the federal entity under what they normally call color of law. But he made it very clear that those courts are not for the general public. They are for federal purposes. And, like, for example, bankruptcy, that's for a federal person. They, when you go in there, they require residency and things like that. And they're putting prima facie evidence on the document that you're a federal person. Now, most people that ask for bankruptcy aid is not a federal person, but they go ahead and let them do it because they don't want anybody to know that they're not a federal person. So it's part of the scam. When you become a federal person, you are taxed. And anytime you do business with the federal entity, you are taxed, potentially taxed if you have a specific increase in your income from that activity. So anytime the, for example, marriage license. Michael talked about nexus, connection with the government, with the United States, with the federal zone in a state. And they basically say that every time they mention, in their written laws, when they mention state, they're talking about a federal zone. They're not talking about land that is not a federal zone. There is land that's not a federal zone that we call states too. But when they say state, they are talking about a federal zone. So when they give you a marriage license, they hand you or at least a form. They want to know your resident address in a county, city, and state. And if you can't give them one, you cannot get a state marriage license because those terms and those locations is what they use to identify you as one of their persons. If you're one of their persons, you're eligible for a marriage license. You're eligible for permission from that state, that jurisdiction, for permission to marry, I guess, and get benefits and be administratively governed by their courts as to the marriage. And guess what? The produce of the marriage is the state has the number one interest in that produce, may it be income or children. Not a good position to be in. Same way with a driver's license. When you go in to get a driver's license, they want the same information as the marriage license. City, county, state. And I don't know if they go after Social Security number or not, but they probably do on the marriage license and the driver's license now. When you go into a bank, they want the same thing. So they're basically attempting to trap you into their jurisdiction on all those things. Now you can they have a duty to provide for your needs if you're not one of their persons. They have to provide accommodations for the free man, is what I call it, the independent man. And when I say independent, I'm talking about independent from the United States. I'm not saying he's independent from his fellow man or God, but I'm just saying independent from the United States. If you're independent from the United States, you don't have any legal nexus with them. And it's not that terribly hard not to have a legal nexus with them, because just stay off their land and don't become one of their employees. And you'll do pretty good. So the other nexus is they talk about, I mentioned the marriage license, the driver's license, state taxes, federal taxes, property tax, real estate tax, all that stuff is associated with that city, county, state of the United States. Sales tax. Michael talked about that. When they go into legislative chambers, may it be the federal government or the state government, they're all talking about the same jurisdiction as taxability. If you make income in their land, you're subject to sales tax. Just that simple. Most business in most areas is not in a federal zone, so you're not subject to sales tax. Very few locations in America can you go in and not pay sales tax unless you go through a legal process to challenge that, which I have. I've walked into lumber yards and bought large purchases and never had to pay any sales tax. And the manager of the place called their lawyer while I was there and explained to him my documents, and the manager of the place came back and told me, he says, I've been here 16 years and nobody's ever done this. He says, I can't believe this. The lawyer said, you're right, that you're not subject to any sales tax. So it's a bluff. You're going in paying a 6%, 7%, 8% tax. I read today that the average tax in America is 6% on purchases. That 6% is probably enough to run all the government's activities. You're talking a tremendous amount of money. If they weren't wasteful, that's enough to run all their activities. But of course, they want more than that. And actually, the more you give them, the more they'll spend. If it costs a lot of money to go to the moon, they'll still go to the moon. If they get enough money, they'll go to Mars and Jupiter and further. You just keep giving them money, they'll keep spending it. And guess what? They'll find the same rocks out there as they do in your backyard. So back to keeping the burden of proof on them, which Michael's talking about. Anytime they come after you, do not make an effort to prove that you're subject to the tax, you're not subject to their tax, or you're not subject to their authority. Don't try to prove that and keep the burden of proof on them completely, because as soon as you start trying to prove that you owe tax or you don't owe a tax, it's not going to go well for you. And our experience is that you must keep the burden of proof completely on them in every aspect. Even if they, we had an individual that he was an elderly guy. We coached him, Ed Shell coached him for at least a month, every day for a month, how to respond to questions in a federal courtroom. And the elderly guy went into the courtroom, an IRS case, and he screwed up within the first 10 seconds of being in there. And Ed Shell was just so angry at him, he just stood up and told him, he said, "Bill, pack your bags. You're going to jail, federal prison." And he walked out and just left the guy. Just after all that work, he is such an idiot that he completely said that he was a United States citizen. Just flat out said he was a United States citizen. Once you say you're a United States citizen in an IRS tax case, you're just the only thing that's left to be adjudicated is how much you owe, how much time you're going to spend in jail for not paying what you should have paid. In their eyes.
DJ, I think what you just said brought here is a perfect segue for something that is new and I believe exciting to share with everyone. You heard me talk about this over the last month that I was working towards this goal. So we're here now. I'm surprising PJ with this announcement. And just to let you know, PJ, that arrangements have already been made that you and John and Chris Ann and Bernie, the whole group, the whole tribe, team, will all be going through or have the opportunity to go through this process through a new information provider we have. His name is Greg. We haven't made arrangements for Greg to do any conference calls yet. That will be in the next few weeks. But it's about correcting the record. The presumption, like PJ was saying, is that you are a federal citizen. And when you use these words and those words and, you know, that, you know, what is your residency? What's your address? You get asked that question. You start replying, you know, 123 Main Street, whatever. You are nailing yourself as a federal citizen. Correcting the record is a $5,000 process that will take a little over 4 to 6 weeks, possibly a little longer, maybe 8 weeks to walk you through it. But the end result is, at the federal level, the record is corrected upon you that you are not a federal citizen, that you are a citizen of one of the freely associated compact states. The federal government will issue you a card. And when that card is run through a law enforcement officer's scanner, up on his screen will come the information, do not investigate, do not detain, release. It's the same thing or very similar to having diplomatic immunity, if you would. A diplomat stopped by, you know, a police officer for doing 90 and a 70 or something like that. They release him, catch and release. This is now being offered. And I just want to share that with you. So if there's anybody on the call that has an interest in pursuing it, get in touch with me. 1-800-625-4250. You, most of you on the call I see here have my direct number anyways. Back to you, PJ.
Yeah, it's interesting. Let's just say you're driving a car down a road, and if you go into a federal zone, you're probably going to get, it's going to be difficult to prevail in the ticket. You can, but it's much more difficult. But if you're traveling on land that is not owned by the United States, which in most areas is the case, the owner of the land has to have some arrangement to prosecute you in common law. So he would have to stop you, which he could use the police officer to do that. And they'd have to write you a ticket, and they would have to convince a jury that you were damaging society. So it would be a much more cumbersome process than sign the ticket, show up, and we'll run you through the cattle call, and you'll before you leave, you'll give us $270. That's how the United States system works. But in common law, it's they gotta convene a jury. It's impartial, and process you with full rights of due process. Which they could do that if they wanted to, but they don't want to because they can't make near as much money per hour doing that as they can the other way. And that's true for everything. Everything they could bring against you, they would have to take it to a jury. And it would have to be a jury that is not selected from a United States jury pool. It would have to be selected from a free and independent people jury pool, which doesn't even exist. You'd have to go out and make those up yourself. There's been situations where people I worked with that were quite knowledgeable on law, Richard McDonald out of California, when he would get a traffic ticket, he would demand a jury trial under common law. And guess what? Under a jury trial under common law, you're afforded all your rights of due process, and they can't bring in United States citizens to be on the jury pool. So they don't want to get out there and tell the people that, hey, you want to be on the jury pool? You're not a United States citizen, so you qualify. The guy goes, I'm not. What's that mean? So now once they come in and sit in an environment like that, they're probably going to get on the Internet and look up some of these people and learn that, a United States citizen is a franchisee and is taxed to death, basically. For a United States person, taxes and death are inevitable. For an American man, death is inevitable. The taxes are not. It's very interesting. They have it set up to where it's actually difficult to, unless you have a lot of knowledge, and it's still difficult, but it's well worth it. I'd rather struggle through life and teach people how to live free and independent than live as a rich man and let them wander down the wrong path all their life. Every man, every pastor, every judge, every person should be learning this and standing up for the rights of the free and independent man, because that is really one of the number right up there is the number one thing that's destroying our country, is that there's very few people that are standing up against the federal government. Very few people stand up against the corrupt police departments. Very few people stand up against the property tax issues, sales tax, the state and federal taxes. And the reason they don't stand up is because a lot of them have mortgages and they don't have time to go and fight these battles because they have to bring in their paychecks. And if they get in a little bit of trouble, they're going to lose their job and their house, and doesn't go well. But you need to stand up and do it. Do the right. You always got to do the right thing. Do the right thing, no matter what it costs. And of course, you can do it a little bit timely. But do the right thing. It's just the right thing to do. I just hate it when people say, "Well, that wouldn't be very profitable for me." Well, then you just confess that you're not much of a man to me if you're more interested in making profit than doing the right thing. Michael, any questions popping up out there on the board?
Sure. Let's go ahead and ask. If you have a question, please press *2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen. *2 to raise your hand, and I will be glad to unmute your line. Ah, Michael. From Las Wages. How you doing?
All right, brother. My question is, if you get a Social Security number, because they tell you you have to have one, while you're a minor, minors can't make contracts.
Yep, you're right.
That's true. That's true. And if you're, let's just say you are 19 years old or 18 years old and you're no longer a minor and you get a Social Security number, they still never disclosed it to you. So if they don't disclose it to you and you can prove that in front of a jury, let's just say they tried to bring it into court and prove that you had a Social Security number, I think you've got to convince the jury that they didn't give you a disclosure, so therefore you don't have a Social Security number for that reason also. But the number one reason you don't have a Social Security number, because if you study the law very closely, you have to be qualified to get a Social Security number. And the qualifications are very, very narrow. I can't remember exactly what they are, but I had a professional researcher dig into this, and it was pretty amazing what the strict limitations on who's supposed to, as a matter of law, have a Social Security number. So if you don't meet those qualifications, anytime they ask you if you have a Social Security number, let's say you're sworn in, do you have a Social Security number, you can just simply reply that I have no evidence in my possession that I ever qualified or was eligible or elected to obtain a Social Security number. So it's three things: qualified, eligible, or elected, which means, you know, you were given full knowledge to make a consensual determination to get one. And then what that does is just a burden to them. And we've done that several times in court, and the federal judge would basically tell the prosecutor, don't go down that alley, move on. We're not going to entertain anything about a Social Security number. Move on. So, but they still got a whole bunch of other ways to trap you, so don't think that you're going to go in here with your Social Security number silver bullet and prevail in a U.S. court. It's difficult to win in these courts, and it's getting even more difficult. But I believe that God has brought the right people into our sphere of interaction here, and we're doing very well with it. I think we're bringing things in that are going to be national norms. We've got some national cases going on now that are probably the biggest cases the federal government's ever touched in on some of these topics. And we've been told that they are just extremely nervous about how to deal with it. And some of the higher level judges have told us that this is something we've been waiting to do for over 35 years. And we just didn't know if it went when the right time to do it. So anyway, if God is with us, we can certainly prevail. So any other questions, Michael?
No, that's the only one for tonight. When they ask me where I live, I usually just tell them I live in my body, because you can't live anywhere else but in your body. And that just dumbfounds them.
Well, you don't have to do that. You don't have to tell them where you live. They ask you, you know, what's your resident address? And you say, you ask them, what are you trying to accomplish here? Are you trying to get a letter mailed to me? Is that what you're asking? Contact information, you know? You just tell them that I have a post location, and you just give it to them. It's no big deal. Give it to them. I've never had any trouble with it. You just give them a post location. It's a post location. It's not a resident address. And then when you're in court, the judge will ask you, or the prosecutor will ask you, is this a resident address? You say, I have no evidence I ever elected to have a resident address in the United States. He'll look at you, and he'll stare at you for like 30 seconds, trying to figure out what to do. And he'll completely go on to a different subject. He doesn't know. He doesn't know how long and dark that alley is. He doesn't want to go down it.
They don't want to have to define their words.
Yeah. So what do you do if somebody asks you if you're in, let's say you're sworn into the witness chair and the prosecutor asks you, are you a U.S. citizen? What do you say?
Oh, I would deny that I'm a U.S. citizen because Congress recognized the Bible as God's word, and it says in the Bible that he knew me before I was born, so obviously I'm a citizen of heaven. I'm just here for a short time.
So you're not a U.S. citizen?
I'm not claiming to be a U.S. citizen or a person.
So the prosecutor would go, yes or no, are you a U.S. citizen or not, sir?
Well, I need to know what the definition of a U.S. citizen is first. And please explain to the jury what a U.S. citizen is.
See, you don't want to go down that alley. All you have to do is say, Mr. Prosecutor, I have no evidence in my possession I ever elected to become a United States citizen. Otherwise, it becomes a charade in front of the jury. And the jury will look at you like you're some kind of a nut. But if you bring it out just that simple, sir, I have no evidence in my possession I ever elected to become a United States citizen. And the jury will go, wow, that was short and sweet. And the jury will notice that the prosecutor won't say nothing for quite a while. like you just got shot right between the eyes. In some situations, the case is dismissed right there. IRS cases are dismissed right at that moment because the judge cannot proceed without that evidence on the record. Don't ever say you're a U.S. citizen and never say you're not a U.S. citizen. Just simply say, I have no evidence I ever elected to become a. And if they say a state citizen, if they say voter's registration, Social Security number, driver's license. I don't care if you got a driver's license card in your pocket. You can still say, I have no evidence in my possession I ever elected to get a motor vehicle's driver's license, operator's license, whatever the state calls it. It doesn't make if you have it in your pocket or not. If they don't go through the right process of qualifying you and making sure that you're eligible for it, you don't have one. So if you don't have one, there goes their evidence that they're trying to get on the record for the judge to proceed administratively. See, if he can't proceed administratively, the jurisdiction defaults to common law, and they can't win in common law. They probably have no jurisdiction to prosecute a written law.
They don't. They don't
charge in common law. Okay, next.
All right, next is Michael. Were there any other questions?
No, I'm good. Thank you.
Super. Thank you. Thanks for checking in tonight. Next is Nita from Spokane.
Don't bet on it. Anyway, Michael, would the process you're talking about, the correcting the record, eliminate some of the things that PJ is talking about here, the need to, well, to do what? I'm not quite sure what that would.
First off, let me just say that I'm exploring this and we'll be exploring it right along with PJ and the rest of the crew. I have no doubt that the outcome is what I'm told it will be. And I will go through it first myself before I make it available to someone else, unless, of course, we have somebody out there that's just brave and will go headlong into something as I would. But that having been said, there are so many possible applications to this. The obvious one on its face value is just having it in your wallet and when you are... when you have, and I've used the word properly as defined, when you have intercourse with government, just don't go there. Anyways, when you have this thing going on with government.
Interaction.
Interaction. Thank you. I'll go with that. And I wasn't being smart aleck when I said intercourse. That's a legitimate expression.
Yeah.
For things other than sexual. Anyways, when you have interaction with the government, you lead off with this card. And following that card is an affidavit that you can also give them if you want. But the card is the key. And that will stop basically everything right there. But what I'm looking at is if I am a citizen of one of the freely associated compact states today, well, I've been that all my life. So back in 1990, when I had a traffic ticket, I'm going to go back and open that case back up, and I'm going to enter that evidence and have it expunged, have it discharged. I was charged. I want discharged. I think it has also people in jail charged with federal crimes. And remember, if it's a state crime, it's still a federal crime. I think there's so much to explore with how that what it can possibly do. So, if anybody wants to join me for the ride, I'm saddling my horse. You can welcome to join me.
One way to look at it, if you're going to a U.S. court, you're going into a U.S. jurisdiction. Okay, it can be a state U.S. jurisdiction, it can be a federal U.S. jurisdiction, but you're going into a U.S. court. So go ahead, Anita.
No, I just say, how would we research that in order to follow along with this, Michael? I'm very interested in what you're talking about here.
Okay. I'm going to be holding classes on this. As I said, I'm going through this myself, but I will be holding classes on it. Greg will be joining me on those classes, as we go through them, if it clicks enough. Well, actually, look, how many ever since PJ and I sat down doing these calls, which is what, over almost 3 years now, PJ, or more?
Probably more.
Yeah, more, I think. I always do a 10-15 minute preamble, and I just cite court cases. I cite court cases that clearly delineate the difference between a state citizen and a federal citizen, a citizen of one of the freely associated compact states versus a federal citizen. So, if you're embracing that, if that already floats your boat, then it's just a matter of coming in. There's a process to be involved to take you from point A to point to the Z, A to Z, and that's what we're walking through. That's what we're walking through, and then we do paperwork on our end. So it's just a matter of you saying, yeah, I've been listening to this for 3 years, and I'm in. I want to do this. I want to correct the record.
Let me make a comment here. When the government is given notice of the truth, okay, like Michael's talking about going back and correcting his true status or whatever.
Correcting your status.
20 years ago on a traffic ticket. See, the government agent has a legal duty to correct the record. And if he doesn't correct the record, he's knowingly and willingly falsifying a government record. That's called a what? Felony. They get very nervous when you start telling them that it's a felony for them not to correct a record. They have to correct the record. To correct a record if there was land jurisdiction at that location, if there was jurisdiction against the person evidenced, if there was evidence that the written law is actually in the books that you supposedly did, So it's the activity, the location, and the person. All three elements has to be part of the crime. And if they find that, you know, Michael is not a person that's eligible to be prosecuted under a specific written law at that particular location doing that particular activity, they have a legal duty to correct the records. And if they don't, it's a felony.
Okay.
That could be for property taxes. That could be for property taxes. That could be for sales tax. That could be for federal taxes, state taxes. They can't steal from you and continue to steal from you because somebody doesn't correct the records.
Okay, so this
would
get
very
court cases where you've been charged and like a traffic ticket, that could be eliminated.
Potentially, I think I could see that possibly on the horizon. I'm not an expert at this, but Michael certainly is going to bring in people that are.
Okay.
So it'll be interesting.
So this would eliminate the need of our Social Security card that when we start to work at a young age of 18, they're informing you that you have to have a Social Security card to go forward. So right there is...
Well, that's just a bluff. We know how to get around that already. But it might make it a lot easier on every level. Social Security, so you know, for a bank, opening a bank account, the requirement for a driver's license, everything, property taxes, federal taxes, state taxes, everything. Do they have a legal nexus, a legal authority to charge you property tax, sales tax, federal tax? Require you to get a driver's license, require to get insurance for your car, require you to get a marriage license, whatever, a Social Security number, whatever. They have to have authority to do it. If they don't have written authority to do it, then they do have written authority to do it upon one of their persons and upon activity that occurs in their land. But if you're not one of their persons and you're not doing an activity in their land, sir, what are you relying upon for your authority to do what you're doing? Some of these cops, they retire. Some of these police chiefs have retired, and they've come to some of our meetings. And they said at the end of their career, they realized that we didn't have authority. We didn't have authority to send our men out there to write tickets all day long. It was all bluff. We didn't have authority. IRS agents come to us and tell us, we realized that we didn't have authority to require most people to pay taxes. It was all bluff. Big scam. Evil. It was evil. A lot of them they lose sleep over it. They quit their job. But go ahead. It sounds like you have some good questions going. Go ahead.
No, I was just wondering how we could further know something about this and know how to stand up for our rights. Sounds like an interesting program.
Every situation is different. Now, I have heard of people that have been arrested, and they were sitting in the back of the car, cop car, and they were looking at the screen when the police officer brought their name up, and they noticed on the bottom of the screen or the top of the screen, I can't remember, that it says do not detain, do not arrest.
Ah.
And one guy was looking at the screen and he read it out loud, and the cop immediately grabs the screen and tips it so the guy couldn't see it. You weren't
supposed to. Did they let him out of the cop car?
Yeah, they let him go. Now if any man sees you doing a felony, he can arrest you. If you see me doing a felony, you can arrest me. Same as any police officer. So that doesn't work on felonies. So don't go out and rob a bank and say, hey, I got my card. I got my card here.
Yeah.
You can't arrest me. You can't.
Yeah, when you said that, all I could think of was Deputy Fife. Yeah.
Take those bullets back. They're hurting my chest. That's good, Michael.
Yeah, that was Officer Barney.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
I love that.
Well,
show.
That was. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, gentlemen, I'll listen for further information. Thank you.
All right, again, ladies and gentlemen, press star 2 on your keypad. Those of you on Freedoms Radio, you'll notice in the center of your monitor a silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side. Left-click inside of it, type away your comment or question. On the outside, you'll see where you can put your contact information, and then hit submit. And I will be more than happy to give voice to your comment or question. Otherwise, we're going to be closing it down for the evening. I'm going to refresh. Anyone else going once? Going twice? Oh, thank you all for joining us this evening. And until next week, good night, everybody, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.